This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. In August, we did a show on redistricting in Indiana and efforts to push for reform in the map-making process. Last week, a group of legislators at the State House created new maps to be considered, and they've now been released to the public. To find out what those maps look like, we're joined by Julia Vaughn, Policy Director at Common Cause Indiana, and Marilyn Moran Townsend, the Republican member of the Indiana Citizens Redistricting Commission. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Julia, who made these new maps and what do they cover?
Well, we're not exactly sure. The way the process works here in Indiana, we have one party that is in control. We're not quite sure what other outside consultants might have been involved, what political organizations might have been involved, but clearly the public had very little involvement, and there's a lot at stake. Where the lines fall for our congressional and state legislative districts will have a huge impact on who gets elected over the next decade here in Indiana. So there's a lot on the line. And as advocates, we're very concerned that this process has been very rushed. There have been very few opportunities for public participation. For example, this morning was the last opportunity scheduled for any public testimony to be taken on congressional, Senate, and a state House of Representative maps. And it happened at 9 a.m. on a Monday morning, which prevents a lot of people from participating. So we're continuing to call for more time, more opportunities for public input, because this is such an impactful process. And there are other maps out there. Our coalition and the group that Marilyn is a part of had a competition, and we solicited a lot of good ideas from Hoosiers all over the state. So today we asked the Senate Elections Committee to consider one of the citizen drawn maps, because we need districts that were drawn without a conflict of interest. And that's inherent when the legislators are in control of the process.
Marilyn, do you agree with what Julia said?
I absolutely do. The maps that were submitted by the Indiana Citizens Redistricting Commission to the General Assembly were developed after months of public hearings in every congressional district in the state. And we heard primarily three things. First of all, that citizens don't believe that they are fairly represented. And secondly, that voters are frustrated by the lack of competitiveness in their districts. And thirdly, that many people believe that their communities of interest were split apart in the last redistricting, harming their influence on issues that they care about. And they see that in the maps that have just been rushed out by the General Assembly. So the input that we received, which actually we've been working on all year, helped us develop criteria for the map drawing contest that Julia just told you about. And from the beginning, we made it public that this was the criteria by which to judge the maps. And it resulted in 60 different maps being submitted from citizens all across the state to the public website. And for almost 2 months, those maps were available for anyone to see and to read what the intent of the map drawer was. So it's been a very public process that the Citizens Redistricting Commission undertook. And we really think it's a model for the state. So in addition to adopting the maps that were drawn by the citizens of our state, we're also urging the legislature to immediately begin the process of reforming the way that we redistrict in this state for 10 years hence.
Well, when it comes to these maps, I want to talk about the ones that were created in the competition, but I do want to also talk about, you mentioned that legislators rushed these out. Julia, how quickly were these new maps proposed by legislators made?
Well, the House of Representatives first made public their proposals for Congress and the House, Indiana House, on the 14th of this month. Just the next day, they started taking public comment. They took 2 days of public comment in the House. Unfortunately, one of those had been scheduled on Yom Kippur, which prevented a lot of our Jewish citizens from participating. Just last week, the Senate maps were made public, But then they were almost immediately amended into the bill in the House of Representatives. So today they took public testimony on Senate maps that have already been inserted in the bill. So that's really a cart before the horse kind of scenario. But we will have, if the General Assembly sticks to the timeline that they've announced, we will have 17 days from the point where these maps were made public to when they could be signed into law by Governor Holcomb. And, you know, keep in mind, these will be in play for the next decade. There is no legal deadline until next month. They actually have until mid-November to finish this process. So there is no harm to anyone for them to give the public a couple more weeks to digest what's being proposed, to figure out how is it going to impact our communities, and provide that feedback to the legislature.
Marilyn, what does the way that the maps from the competition play a role into this? I just want to make sure I'm understanding this correctly. The legislators are drawing their own maps and the citizens were coming up with their own maps.
That is correct. And we use the three criteria that I mentioned earlier to judge the maps that were presented. So the first, to increase fair representation, Greg Knott of Bloomington submitted the winning United States Congress map. And Mr. Knott noted that his goal was a congressional map that would give the two major political parties a share of seats that's proportional to their statewide vote share. And his winning maps would likely produce 6 Republican districts and 3 Democrat districts, with 4 of the 9 districts being ones that could swing between each party depending upon future election trends. And that contrasts with the legislators having drawn a map that would likely retain the 7-2 GOP majority in Congress. So that's the first, was that to increase fair representation on our U.S. congressional map, we've got one that really does that very well, that was the winning map. And then the second criteria, which was to enhance competitiveness, and the Indiana Citizens Redistricting Commission's winning state Senate map was drawn by Adam Stant of Indianapolis. And in his statement of intent, he noted that his map was drawn to maximize electoral competition. And his entry was successful in achieving that goal using the 2016 governor's race as his barometer. Mr. Stant's Senate map would produce an equal number of seats for Republicans and Democrats in the state Senate. And he also sought to avoid dividing counties, cities, and townships. Now, you contrast that with what the legislators have drawn. It's a map that would likely retain the current GOP supermajority that's existed for the past decade. And it shows, particularly in our urban centers. I'm from the Fort Wayne area. And Fort Wayne is, instead of its current 3 districts, it's being cracked into 4 districts. This is in stark contrast to the citizen map, which would split Fort Wayne into only 2 districts, north and south, and would particularly keep communities of interest and minorities together. Whereas the 4 districts that are proposed in the legislative map would take the citizens of the cities and really drown out their votes and their power to be heard at the polls by all of the surrounding rural residents around Fort Wayne, and actually not even very close, about 50 miles away from Fort Wayne. So you know, that's an example of a map that really does take into account more political interest than enhancing competitiveness. And I really think that competitiveness equates to fairness, and that's really a Hoosier value. The third criteria, to preserve communities of interest, the Citizen Commission's winning House map was created by Fort Wayne's Jorge Fernandez, who's a respected educator in our community. And in his statement of intent, Mr. Fernandez submitted with his entry, he noted that his first mapping goal was to respect the principle of one person equals one vote while preserving the communities of interest. So there's a really stark difference. I think that the legislature could certainly improve the outcome by adopting the Indiana Citizens Redistricting Commission maps, citizen drawn maps. And there's so much to learn from how we can respect what it is that our voters have most asked for by giving our redistricting process a second look before they send this on to the governor.
I mean, that sounds like a very interesting process, and the fact that all these citizens came up with different ways to come up with a redistricting map. Julia, we have about 2 minutes left. Why don't we just use the citizens' maps?
Well, because this is a process that is controlled by those who will run in the districts. We certainly think that that's a fatal flaw with the maps that are produced by the legislature. There's this conflict of interest, and no matter how good or how bad the resulting districts are, you're always going to have a significant chunk of Hoosiers who don't trust the process, nor should they. Legislators are just too close to this process to conduct it fairly. And that's not a knock on Republicans. Democrats, when they're in control in other states, they do the same thing. So we need to have a process. What we've been saying all along is it's about the process. If you have an open, transparent, and fair process, then you can produce fair maps. But without that, it is very difficult because the pressure inside the state house is all about winning the next election. It's not about ensuring that all Hoosiers are able to make their voices heard in elections. So unfortunately, we have a flawed process. We'll likely end up with with flawed maps. But I do think we have made a compelling argument folks like Marilyn participating, that there is a better way to do this. And we need to hand the job over to citizens, have them in charge of the redistricting process. And only then will we get maps that fairly represent all Hoosiers.
Thank you so much to both of you for joining us this afternoon. Julia Vaughn is the policy director at Common Cause Indiana, and Marilyn Moran Townsend is the Republican member of the Indiana Citizens Redistricting Commission. If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can always reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. In 2018, Donye Deon Jones was found hanging from a tree in the backyard of his family's home in Missouri. Police labeled his death a suicide, while members of his family say Donye was lynched. Today, we're talking to two documentarians who started a podcast investigating his death. We're joined by Ray Novoshelsky and John Duffy, co-creators and co-hosts of After the Uprising, The Death of Donye Deon Jones, and the co-founders of Double Asterisk, an Indiana-based investigative media company. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you.
Yeah, Ray, thank you.
Let's start with you, Ray. Who was Donye Deon Jones?
Well, he was a 24-year-old young man living in St. Louis County, Missouri. Unfortunately, we didn't get to know him personally. We got to know his mother and his family beginning about 6 months after his death, but we did eventually get access to his cell phone and along with a lot of his friends, and feel that we've gotten a pretty good picture of him as a guy who, you know, had a big vision for his life. He was trying to figure it out a little bit, but he was on a track towards real estate, kind of inspired by his uncle, Melissa's sister. And he was making inroads there. He was figuring out that business. He eventually wanted to do something in Africa. He was, by all accounts, a very funny guy. If you knew him, he was a very goofy, silly person, very protective of his activist mother, who, you know, had helped start the Ferguson movement for police reform 4 years before his death. And, you know, just a guy who really wanted to protect the people closest to him.
How did you find out about this case?
Well, Duffy found it initially, but it was eating up social media. You know, Melissa first, she made this decision. It was a very difficult decision, as she describes it to us, that shortly after her son was buried, she decided that she would post the photo of that her brother and her husband had taken of her son hanging from this tree. And that was partially to sort of shock the public, to show them that, you know, when you see it for yourself, something just kind of doesn't look right. And it looks like it requires further investigation. And so, you know, essentially she was calling out for help from the media. And we thought that if we were looking to do a podcast at that point in time, we had to try that form of journalism. And we thought that's the perfect for this kind for this case, because instead of showing up, asking a few questions and leaving, we felt like we could stick around for what turned out to be 2.5 years to really try to get to the bottom of this.
That's a lot of time to dedicate to a project. John, what made you decide to get involved with this?
I had seen a lot of stories coming out of Ferguson. Obviously, we all watched the massive Ferguson uprising that happened after the death of Mike Brown and the non-indictment of Darren Wilson. And there had been a lot of stories coming out of Ferguson and the greater St. Louis area mentioning that people who'd been involved in activism there had died, perhaps mysteriously. And having seen those stories kind of crop up over the years and no one ever doing a hard look at them was sort of shocking to me. I just kept waiting for that moment when someone was going to do like the deep dive on either all of these deaths or one of these deaths. And it never really happened. So when we saw, you know, that Danye had died in the way that he did, Ray and I discussed it and we're like, well, you know, Melissa, Danye's mother, is clearly looking to shine a light on this story. You know, I guess maybe it just has to be us that does it. So we emailed her and got on the phone with her, and it was a slow process to sort of build the relationship and build the trust, but we told her that we would be there for the long haul, and she welcomed us in.
You know, I heard Ray mention that you were able to get access to Danye's cell phone. That seems like quite an intimate thing to be able to access. What was that like?
It was first a difficult thing to do because we were trying to go a standard route of just having a friend, an ex-girlfriend who might know the passcode, get in touch with her and see if she knew it so we could open it. And then we eventually sent it to a company that could bypass it for us with, you know, a computer program. And then, yeah, you get into it and you see the types of video games someone likes to play. You see, you know, what music they listen to in the last week of their life. You find old videos on a Google Drive of them hanging out with their friends. It's bizarre. You know, it's a bizarre modern thing when people's devices can contain so much about them. There's, you know, a closeness you can almost feel, which is again bizarre because it's digital and it's a fantasia. It's not a real closeness to this person, but you feel it regardless. But then it's also sort of gut checking because, you know, you find things in there that you aren't told by the people around them because they didn't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, was that able to offer a sense of closure for the family to be able to see some of the stuff in there?
You know, we're trying to navigate this. We've been struggling to do this ever since we started doing media around this project. There's 11 episodes, and so we've sort of taken people on a journey, and I think each episode adds something to the insight around this case and maybe around some of the bigger issues that we're trying to get at, and in particular around, you know, what's happening in St. Louis County and what maybe needs fixed. So I don't mean to be evasive. It's in one of the later episodes that we finally managed to get into the phone, and I'll just say that Duffy mentioned the word, I think, gut check. There was, you know, it revealed a lot to us in terms of how little there was to seemingly support depression or any calls for help or any apparent suicidal tendencies, which fit with what the family had said. But there was something that we found, and I'll just leave it to your listeners to go on this journey with us, or I would ask that invite them to do so. But there was something that we found that made us check our own where we felt we were leaning regarding this case.
So we will have to listen to every episode.
every single one of them.
Yeah. I mean, I listened to at least the first one, and I'll say that it was heartbreaking, and it's a little bit hard to listen to when you hear a parent talking about their child. How was it for you being the person speaking with someone firsthand and going through this emotional journey?
I got the impression that Melissa was looking for, and her family really were looking for avenues towards healing. And unfortunately, this isn't the first time we've been in that position. Our very first film, when we were in our early 20s, we interviewed a number of the family members, you know, people who lost people on 9/11. And they, you know, they told us there really is never any closure in these situations, that closure is this kind of elusive myth. But I think there's probably forms of closure. And I think if in some cases, people like Melissa trying to feel that she'd been heard, feel she'd gone through every possible approach to understand what had led to her son's death, I think there was an element of closure to that process. And so I guess in that way, it was an honor to be, you know, involved in working with her to bring that out.
John, can you tell us about St. Joseph County in Missouri and the significance of this location to the story?
I think you mean St. Louis County.
Oh, sorry about that.
No, no, it's okay. I'm sure I'm not wrong. but yes, the case takes place in St. Louis County, which is outside of St. Louis, the city. It sort of envelops it to the north and to the west. And it's obviously an interesting place, like any outside of a major metropolitan area, because it's got its hard racial lines that sort of exist from, you know, the last 100 years of redlining and all that sort of, you know, racist districting. And then some of those lines have started to shift and blur, and there's a lot of interesting things that happen with policing because of that, due to the fact that some of the municipalities in the county have their own police forces and municipal courts, such as Ferguson, which is very famous. Some do not, like the Spanish Lake area where Melissa lived, which gets all its policing on contract through the county. And, you know, you're often dealing with a situation where the police who are working in a particular area do not live in that area. They're not from that community. And sometimes, you know, I'm not going to say all times, but sometimes are hostile to that community. And it's something that I think really can't be understood even by me. I mean, unless you really live there and live in it. But we've got some great descriptions of it from people we spoke with over the course of the podcast, including Melissa's cousin, a young man named Tef Poe, who's a rapper and, you know, sort of an intellect who has done a fellowship at Harvard, and he's got his own journalistic project now. So, but he, among others, gave us a real sort of visceral sense of what that's like to exist there.
Well, John, earlier you were mentioning that no one was doing a hard look into this case. Do you think part of it is the result of shrinking newsrooms? People just don't have the resources anymore to investigate these things? Or is it more of a systemic problem where certain cases just aren't looked into?
I think you probably have a bunch of factors feeding into it. I think some of it is just a question of resources, whether on the part of journalists or on the part of local law enforcement and medical examiner's offices. I think there are inherent biases that people carry, which might not even be what people, I think I mean by saying that, it's not necessarily even in all cases just like, oh, a racism issue, but just an issue of, you walk in, you see a body, you see a rope, it's a suicide, let's move on. Sort of a bias towards the simplest explanation that requires the least amount of paperwork, and sort of leaning on everybody else's biases who came to the situation before you. I think insofar as journalism is concerned, you have issues of access where local journalists who deal with, let's say, the media wing of a police department on a regular basis, they don't want to burn them. You know, they can push a little bit, but they can't push too hard, because these are people they have to deal with and work with all the time in order to continue doing their own jobs. And, you know, relationships develop there as well, where if they hear, like, you know, if someone from the local paper calls up and speaks to the media rep for the police, and that media rep says, oh, we're just looking at it as a suicide, it's no big deal. You know what I mean, Chip? You know, and Chip's like, yeah, okay, I trust you, Jim. I've talked to you about all the cases. You know, there's relationships there that prevent people from, like, stopping and going, well, hold on a second. And so I think it's multifactorial, but I think we had an advantage in the fact that we're not from there, and that we only work for ourselves. So it's like, if we don't want to go away, we don't have to go away.
And if I could, add to that, because it's been a subject that's fascinated us our whole career, we seem to keep picking somehow these third rail subjects and thinking that if we approach them just right, that somehow it'll be like the magic bullet that causes them to get covered. You know, and Danye, because of the way Melissa did it with dropping that viral post with the shocking photo and then holding a press conference, she did get both local and a lot of national media. But what we find they tend to do is they're not, look, if a media organization does an original investigation, then they're putting themselves out there for lawsuits, for the possibilities of libel. They've got to, you know, it's much harder than just reporting on an allegation that a grieving mother is throwing out there into the world and then reporting on what the cops say in response and then leaving it sit. You know, so, but the weird thing to me is that now all these places that reported on this, you know, we've tweeted at them, we've emailed at them, we've said, look, you guys did great original reporting in the beginning, but we've taken this ball much further. And I think your listeners, your viewers are going to want to know about the things that are in this podcast. And I've been a little shocked by the lack outside of public radio in St. Louis and public radio now in Indianapolis who've taken an interest.
I wonder if it's because there are so many crime podcasts now. Maybe people are getting used to that, or you know, maybe it's kind of I don't want to say a slap in the face, but it's like, look what we found that you didn't.
Right. Yeah. There's synergy too. I mean, I hate to be cynical about this, but we have a publicist out in St. Louis who's close with a lot of local media, and they've kind of told, some of them have told him off the record, well, this is an iHeart podcast, and we don't do something where we promote another company's work. And it's like, yeah, but it's not about the podcast. It's about what we found in the podcast that affects how people perceive St. Louis County government.
You know? Right. And Ray, when you got Melissa on board, I mean, how was that? Were you able to get her fairly quickly, or did it take some convincing?
Well, Duffy can tell the best story on that, because my wife and business partner, Ruth Vaca, was pregnant with our first child. And so literally when around the time Melissa was saying yes, and we realized we had to do an in-person with her to really start to build trust and see if this was real, that was literally while I was waiting, you know, for to go to the hospital with my wife. So Duffy went out there. And Duffy, what did you find?
Yeah, so I drove out there during a snowstorm in a rental car with bald tires. And I got to a cheap motel by the airport that I'd selected, you know, by throwing a dart at a map. And there was sort of a soft yes that Melissa would meet us. She was suggesting, yes, I will, but wouldn't set a real hard time. And I just was spending the weekend there going, okay, hopefully, you know, Saturday or Sunday, she eventually shows up. And eventually she did show up. She showed up with her sister Toya. And she was immediately very nervous that I was waiting in the lobby for her. And the fact that I even recognized her right away, which was because I'd watched all the media, but that sort of took her aback. She was still in a place of being quite paranoid, very stressed out, obviously very still dealing. You know, she's still obviously heartbroken at the loss of her child. But that moment was only, you know, 5-6 months out. So she was dealing with a lot, and you know, I was doing my best to navigate that and not act like a total wing nut. But ultimately, she comes up to, you know, the room, and we sit and we chat, and she starts opening up and telling about some of the oddities and the people that had been around and the way the police had treated her the morning of. And her sister did a wonderful job sort of bridging the gap between me and Melissa, you know, keeping the situation light. But you know, I'll say there was a moment we all laughed about 2 years later when I noticed Melissa had this bag on her lap that she just would not let go of. And she was kind of fidgeting, playing with. And I had presumed she had a gun in there. And then 2 years later, she's like, yeah, I had a gun in there. And you know, and then we all chuckled about it because, you know, but you know, that's, it just speaks to her mind state at the time.
Right. I mean, it's mostly the trauma, probably just, trying to get over what's happening and trying to regain trust with folks.
And not knowing who at all to trust. You know, she felt very quickly she couldn't trust the police. You know, she had been in a period where she'd been dealing with threats, you know, over the preceding years due to her activism. So when all of a sudden these threats you've been getting, whether sort of anonymously or, you know, on the internet and things like that, when all of a sudden this tragedy manifests that just doesn't look right to you, it's hard for you to not presume that they're connected. And if they're connected, then who's this stranger from out of town coming, trying to bring me to a motel by the airport? You know, it all makes sense.
And I mean, it's pretty hard in general for folks to open up to journalists. How were you able to get folks to open up to you not representing a specific media outlet, for example? We have about 30 seconds. We can pick this up after break, but if you want to take a quick...
I think the short version is that a lot of the original Ferguson frontline activists were very skeptical, I think, of the mainstream media. So it may have actually helped that we came in independent and stayed, kept showing up.
All right. We'll pick back right off of that when we get back after this break. We're continuing our conversation with the co-hosts of After the Uprising, The Death of Donye Dion Jones. If you have any questions or comments for the program, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All in Vox Pop. Just search for All in Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send us your question or comment, and we'll try to get it onto the show. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Back now to our discussion on a new podcast about the death of Donye Dion Jones, who was found hanging from a tree in the backyard of his Missouri home in 2018. We're joined by Ray Novoselsky and John Duffy, co-creators and co-hosts of After the Uprising, and the co-founders of Double Asterisk, an Indiana-based investigative media company. Before the break, we touched on the ability to get folks to open up to you both. Ray, you said part of it was not being from mainstream media. Did that help you as well to connect with law enforcement?
look, I can promise you that our vision for this was that we were going to talk with everybody involved with this case, both on the side grieving for Donye and the side that looked into what happened and ultimately ended up determining suicide. And we were getting a little bit ignored, and we saw an opening at one point shortly after Duffy had met with Melissa, as he described. We went and knocked on the door of the lead detective. We were holding notepads, and we sort of sheepishly explained who we were and that we were interested in kind of getting to know him and getting to know, you know, his side of the story. And it didn't have to happen then, but could we schedule something? And, you know, I'll leave it to the listeners to hear. There was a lot of fallout from that first moment. We ended up, there's a moment in, I think it's episode 4 of the podcast, where you hear my conversation that followed with the information officer from St. Louis County, essentially berating me, but trying to figure out what it was we were looking for. And I begged him, I said, here's what's going to happen. If you guys, you cut us out and you refuse to be involved with this because you think this is a hit job, and then down the line this comes out and you get to complain, oh, it's this one-sided hit job, but you're making it so right now, and we don't want it to be that. And if our listeners are not able to see the police in three dimensions and understand, you know, what they went through during the Ferguson uprising and how that shaped what they're looking at and how they go into these investigations, then they're not going to see them as real flesh and blood, you know, human beings, the way they're going to see the, you know, these activists and these family members. So please help us help you. And things only got kind of weirder and more antagonistic from there. Yeah. So no, it didn't help.
Well, John, did working on this podcast affect you at all, like emotionally, mentally, take a toll?
Yeah. And in punctuated periods, I mean, it gets, you know, it comes and goes in waves depending on, you know, what's going on with it. There are moments where, you know, not a lot going on and, you know, working on other things. And then there's moments when we, you know, dive heavy into something that is happening with Melissa or out in St. Louis. And then, you know, there are just these moments of, and I don't want to spoil them from the show, but where just certain things happen that we just would never have believed. And that, yeah, it would shake me. There was definitely a moment, again, I'm being all mysterious, not being specific, but there was definitely one thing, and people will know it when they hear it. But when we discovered it, I definitely spent a night or two feeling almost like personal loss. But, you know, throughout, I think there is this great thing. One of the sort of co-producers on the show, Matt McDonough, said when, you know, he had gotten done listening to all of our cuts, where he said by the end, he's like, you guys just sound tired. And of course we had before release re-record all of our voiceovers. Maybe we don't sound quite so tired in the finished product, but I think it speaks to how draining it was to spend 2 to 2.5 years banging our heads on a wall right alongside Melissa.
Because beyond even then that initial relationship with the police, as we started finding things that we felt like this could really, if you had subpoena power, you could take this a step further and maybe even find a potential culprit if this is a murder. And right, as he said, banging our heads against a wall that included, you know, a hope around the first Black prosecutor of St. Louis County, Wesley Bell, and the idea we might develop a relationship with him, our attempts working with a kind of a, you know, famous state senator named Maria Chappelle Nadal, who had represented Ferguson and first raised the issue of some of these Ferguson mystery deaths, you know, her help getting to the county council. And there was even the FBI comes into the mix at some point later in the show. And as again, without giving away too much, there were very frustrating moments that I think left John and I and Melissa reeling and unsure what to think.
Well, we won't pull any more details out of you, so you can keep it a surprise. I think, you know, I like to listen to the podcast when I'm on a walk, so I'm probably going to have to take like 3-4 walks today to catch up, because now I'm very intrigued.
Well, can I just say that, because you said that first episode's hard to listen to, and I think everybody agrees, but but I think it's very rewarding and emotionally satisfying, and you get to know Danye and his family in a way that I think then – as you go through the rest of the journey, like, I think it lightens a little bit. It gets very intriguing. The people that you meet and get to know are incredibly interesting. And whatever you think at any given time in a certain episode of the show, you may think the opposite in the next episode. It's a very twisty, turny show.
Well, let's pivot a little bit so we don't spoil anything else for the show, so folks can tune in. John, who were the people that were helping you to put this podcast together?
In the I'm just gonna laugh at every question. Because of the journey that it was, even behind the scenes. Really, in the beginning, it was just me and Ray on a wing and a prayer, and then it was, you know, like that for quite a long time. And we reached out to a lot of potential partners in the podcast world, a lot of them, and got really close with some. You know, potential people who would sign on and finish this out with us, and they didn't. It never worked out for whatever reason, you know, and no hard feelings anywhere, but it just didn't work out. And then in the end, we also had a lot of help on that front from our producer, Dave Cassidy, who's worked with Ray for a long time in the documentary film world. And we had some interns that helped us out from IU that came in and did a lot of grunt work for us on various fronts. And so we're grateful to all of them. And then eventually, right at the end, we thought we were just going to self-release this. We thought, like, okay, we have no distribution deal. That's fine, but we got to get this out there. And then that's when we heard from Matt McDonough from Now This, who had been interested in the story of his own volition and had reached out to Melissa. And Melissa said, oh, hey, I'm already doing this podcast with these guys. And so we hooked up, and it turned out behind the scenes a bunch of, you know, everybody knows everybody in industry stuff, and things worked out well in that regard. Now This helped us get through to iHeartRadio.
Mm-hmm. Well, we do have a clip from Mallory Kinoy, an intern for the podcast, talking about her experience working on the show. Let's take a listen.
I just feel like the coolest thing for me was them giving me the opportunity to actually like work on the scripts and seeing the information I knew, and was like, when I collected all of that, like, audio for them, and I wrote all of those notes, I didn't expect them to actually let me like do much with it. Like, I was just handing them over the information for them to work with, but I thought it was really cool that they respected like my knowledge and my storytelling abilities enough to allow me to give them feedback on the scripts and work on some scripts and like actually use what I was telling them. So
how does it feel to hear that?
I love the IU intern program, and we continue to use it. And we've gotten so many great people from there, and some of them continue to kind of collect sort of one-off paychecks here and there from us. Honestly, it was so rewarding to, because when we started the internship, we had a discussion where we said, like, all right, we're not gonna be able to pay these people. They will get, you know, IU credits, but like, we want to make sure we're not taking advantage. They're getting as much out of it as we are. And so for them to be, you know, for us to record those credits where we named the five with the titles that they had well earned, felt rewarding that, you know, we were able to give something back to them for all they had provided.
And John, is there anything you would do differently with the podcast if you had the chance to do it all over again?
Oh, yeah, but it'd probably be really embarrassing to say it all. Ray, you go first.
What would I do differently? You know, we're debating right now if a season two would be warranted and what it would potentially be about. So I'll dodge the question a little. I'm fascinated by what this points to in a couple areas. One, I'm curious how much more there is about any federal monitoring that was done of original Ferguson activists and Black Lives Matter activists around the country. And if there's been a lot more on that front than we might suspect up till now. And I'm very interested in the question of how much some white supremacist groups may outright overlap at times, and this is an uncomfortable issue, with police departments. Not systemic racism, but overt, you know, the Departed style people trying to get like-minded folks into certain systems to influence those systems type of thing. So I wish we'd done more with that.
That sounds kind of scary and ominous.
Mm-hmm. I think it's scary and ominous because I think a lot of things we found maybe point towards that not being as crazy as it might sound.
Right. Well, John, there are conversations you had. Are there any that stand out to you as the most memorable?
Yeah. And Ray, you know, he and I split a lot of the work. So we each talked to different people and sort of took different angles at times. Both of us interacted with the family heavily, but then kind of went towards our specialties. One of the things I love doing in this investigative work is kind of digging into the details of the investigation, of the technicalities. And one of those conversations that stands out to me is with Dr. Mary Case, who's the chief medical examiner of St. Louis County. And the reason it stands out to me, I think, is because it hits me harder and harder every time I listen to it, because it starts to, what I get from it is, it's not that she doesn't care. It's just that everything is just sort of a process, and there aren't the checks and balances we think we have in some of these systems are not. There's just sort of a throughput and sort of a stamp the thing and let's move on. And so, yeah, one of the clips I gave you is of me speaking with her, Dr. Mary Case.
One of the things that we found interesting was that Dr. Case hadn't heard about the DNA swabs taken from the bedsheet.
Were there swabs or any samples taken in this case?
I don't know, but I would very much doubt it.
If I can talk to you about that real quick, when they say that she didn't come from their house, we have found in the course of our investigation that there was DNA pulled off of that sheet, and it was Donye's DNA, and then an unidentified male's DNA. But to me, the one thing that sort of stands out is that not only does Melissa claim that they just don't have extra sheets in the house, they just have enough for the beds, but her DNA is not on that sheet. They didn't find any unidentified female DNA, and she's the one who does all the house's laundry. It's pretty hard to prove a negative, like, I didn't own that. And they weren't ever told that DNA was tested on it. It was something that we found out, and then that we told them, and never made the medical examiner's report. You weren't even aware.
Well, no, we never get any of that.
But wouldn't you know that it...
We never get DNA results back. That doesn't interact with our decisions. That's not how we base our decisions.
Let's pause here for a second. This is bizarre. The medical examiner's office is responsible for determining cause and manner of death. A second or third set of DNA on a lethal instrument could in fact be the evidence they need to move a determination from suicide to homicide, or at least to undetermined. It could be the evidence they claim they are yet to see. Couldn't it?
Well, powerful.
Yeah, and then the other clip I gave you is of Deja Jones, who was a former girlfriend of Donye's, and she'd been an activist herself. And the reason it was so powerful, I think, to me is because she really hits home with why she doesn't believe Danya took his own life. And she's not a family member, and she's not does not have a good relationship with Danya's family. So it's not like she's defending them or their position. It's really what she believes.
When I tell you, when me and Danya was together, John, we went through a lot of stuff. Me and Danya went through homelessness together. We went through a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm saying. We went through so much, and he never once, you get what I'm saying?
Like he had been through so much adversity,
yes.
And that never came up.
No.
So
and
what would
I'm
this
saying.
Be?
Like, how would he want to do bad to himself when he was doing good? You get what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. That's what I don't get. When we were doing bad, Daye was strong as a mug. He was so strong. I was the weak one, mm-hmm. crying and, oh my God, what are we going to do? He was, babe, it's going to be okay. I'm finna get the job at FedEx. He got a job at FedEx. And like I keep telling you, Daye wasn't doing, he wasn't in a bad position. Even when he was in a bad position, he was still looking for positivity. Mm-hmm. I don't get, like I said, it don't line up with me because we went through the worst. I just can't put that in my head. I'm sorry.
Which is fair. Which is fair.
That's just not the Danya that I knew.
Wow, all these clips are really compelling, and I want to know more.
Well, for anyone who wants to know more, I'd ask any of your listeners right now while they're thinking about it, pull out your phone, pull up your podcast app, whether it's Spotify, Apple, search After the Uprisings. After the Uprising, The Death of Danya Dion Jones. Subscribe right now. If you get a chance, please leave comments, rate us. It all helps. It all helps for this type of work to, you know, have the potential to make an impact in the future.
What's next for the both of you after this podcast?
Well, I know this Friday, we're at 6 p.m. at Morgan Stern's bookstore in Bloomington. We're going to be speaking for an hour. They've asked us to talk as part of Banned Books Week about our experience with this and other journalism. And then, well, Duff, do you want to talk about Origins?
We have another podcast out right now that we're independently releasing called Origins, Birth of a Pandemic, also available on all the podcast platforms. You can subscribe right now. Basically, it's been a deep dive look into the possibility that the SARS-CoV-2 virus escaped from a lab in Wuhan and what that would look like. And it's based on interviews with scientists and researchers from around the world. And it sort of explores the some of the conflict of interest things that exist within the scientific world in that regard.
And for folks who are listening right now, let's say they have an idea about an unsolved case. Can they contact you? Is that something that you're dedicated to doing, or is this just a one-off?
Oh, we'll definitely hear more. And we've continued to collect stories that have come from people who've heard this podcast or knew Danya or had similar experiences with that Detective Anderer. And at the end of each episode, there's a hotline that we give. So if they skip to the end of the episode, call that hotline and leave a message, we will get that message. Or go to our website, doubleasteriskmedia.com. It's like an asterisk, but there's two of them, doubleasteriskmedia.com. And they can find our contact info if they want to get in touch.
Well, thank
also
you both.
Facebook and Twitter. Yeah,
right.
Well, thank you both for joining us. We appreciate it. Ray Novoselsky and John Duffy are the co-creators and co-hosts of After the Uprising, The Death of Danya Dion Jones, and the co-founders of Double Asterisk, an Indiana-based investigative media company. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Cross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.